Who would base their lives on a brutal, contradictory book of fairy stories? That's my summary of the objections that we received. We got a lot of them which touched on the Bible, probably about 20 or so, which referred to the Bible in some way. But the following nine, I hope, are a pretty good summary of the questions or objections that we had. So I'm just going to read them out so you can see what we heard and then why I've turned it into the question I have. And so here's a bunch of those objections we had. First one was, the hypocrisy of the Bible and how Christians seem able to ignore it. For example, the many contradictory verses in the Bible are usually met with, that's not how it's supposed to be interpreted. Next one, you assert that the Bible is the word of God, but that's only what its human, keyword number one, authors claim, keyword number two. So how exactly can you convince me without this self-referential loop and thereby invalid recourse to what the Bible says that it really is, that what it says really is the word of God? Next person said, the Bible was written by humans in the Bronze Age, and much of it, the account of how the world was made, where evil came from, is profoundly illogical and was clearly written as a mythical interpretation of reality in a pre-scientific age, such that only the most irrationally devout of Christians believe it. Next one said, my greatest doubt in Christianity is the fact that the entirety of its doctrine is based on a single, highly questionable source, the Bible. Somebody else said, Yahweh says, show them no mercy. And Jesus says, love your enemies. And yet Christians claim that both are God. Another one, I don't like the idea that a group of people or a book written by people has the power to judge others and know right from wrong. I've often wanted to explore religion, but I find it unreachable and incompatible with my fundamental values. One more, people who think that every single thought or idea presented in the Bible is a literal commandment of God, regardless of context or the prejudice of the biblical author, aka the human element. Just two more. My neighbor objects because although his wife is a Christian, he cannot believe the Bible stories. They seem like fiction to him. And finally, probably the most blunt one, the Bible is riddled with demonstrably false information and hideous moral lessons. This is incompatible with an omniscient and all-loving God. Your religion is false. The end. Okay? Which I thought was... No, I think it's good. If you're going to state an objection, state it strongly. Why not? That's what I'd do. So, who would base their lives on a brutal, contradictory book of fairy stories? And the answer is, of course, nobody would. And to my knowledge, nobody does. I've never met anybody who bases their lives on a contradictory book of fairy stories. Nobody I've ever met bases their lives on the Brothers Grimm or on Hans Christian Andersen. And the reason why I'd say that that question framed that way would really have no challenge to a Christian believer in a sense, is I say that for two reasons. The first reason is that the Bible is not a brutal, contradictory book of fairy stories. And the second reason is that actually Christians, when looked at carefully, don't ultimately base their lives on the Bible. So we'll look at those one after the other, and then at the end we're going to come back and look at all of the objections we started with and attempt to just give a quick answer to how we would go about responding to all of those. And the first reason I say nobody would base their lives on a brutal, contradictory book of fairy stories is that the Bible isn't a brutal, contradictory book of fairy stories. In fact, it's not even a book. It's a library of ancient documents written across many hundreds and thousands of years. There's some primeval narratives in there, how the world was formed. There's some family history in there. There's a lot of legal material. There's some imperial and military history. There's some poems, some proverbs, some visions, four biographies of Jesus, and 20-odd letters. So it's very diverse. It's a collection of lots of documents written by lots of different people over a very, very long period of time. Twice as long as there has been such a thing as the English language is the length of time we have been collating. You know, the Roman Empire to now is about the length of time over which the Bible was written. And some of the documents in that collection do contain some scenes of extreme brutality. They do, because they are describing military and imperial history. And that's just the nature of the fact. If you read a book about a war, the chances are it's going to contain a lot of people dying. And in fact, if it didn't, you would ask questions about whether the person recording the war knew what they were talking about. If you read Churchill's five volumes of you know, history or whatever it is, 5 or 6 volumes on the Second World War, and nobody died, you would probably come away thinking, this is not written by Winston Churchill. This is written by someone else pretending to be him, because in real wars, people die. So you would find, I suppose, to some degree, I'd have to concede that parts of the Bible are brutal, because they do describe wars that actually took place, historical conquests and battles and the formation of empires that actually happened. And you could cross-check an awful lot of that context. Basically, the nearer to now the sources are, the more other sources there are and the more you can cross-check them. But you can cross-check them with other stories and other accounts from parts of the world in the same area, and you can find out, oh, that's who that king was. Oh, I see. Oh, yeah. And some of them are even things that the British Empire, when we were invading people's countries and stealing all their stuff, that we stole quite a lot of things like that. And we've got some of them in the British Museum because we nicked them from the Persians or the Greeks. And you can read the cylinders if you read the language or read the codices or the scrolls and compare them with the Bible, and you can see, oh, that's that character here and that's that guy there. It happens all the time. So, but there are real wars in human history. There were real wars in the Middle East in the Bronze Age, and so the Bible's got lots of that in it because that's the nature of telling history of that period. So yes, there's some, in that sense, there are some bits which are, you might say, brutal. Some of the texts, poems, visions and proverbs, are not often meant to be taken literally. This is another thing that some people will struggle to hear, because they will assume that if something is from God, it must be all literal. But the fact is that language doesn't work that way, that a lot of language is not meant to be heard or read literally, that when you encounter all sorts of things in our world, you know that's not a literal description of something that happened. And I've probably used several turns of phrase, even in the course of this first 5 minutes, that have used things that are not meant to be literal. And the songs we sing are full of them, and poems and love songs and proverbs often contain things like that. We'll look at a few examples as we go. And that means that to say that they're not fairy stories, because they're not intended to be taken as once in a galaxy far, far away, but neither are they literal accounts of things. They're often descriptions or challenges to people living in a particular day that contain very metaphorical or symbolic language, because that's what language does. That's how it works. And so we have to read them with careful attention to how literature functions, what it's supposed to do. And that context can be very important and also difficult to get right if we're not familiar with the language. And some of these accounts even present different perspectives. They present different perspectives on God, different perspectives on humans, different perspectives on historical events. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they contradict each other, but it does mean that you have to read them carefully and think, so what actually happened here? And how do I reconcile this angle with that angle on this particular event? And the difficulty with all of that stuff that we have is that you and I tend to read texts as if they're written by people like us to people like us. And they're not. They're written by people totally unlike you, who would never have seen anything like this room or these lights or the clothes you're wearing or the glasses you have on. They would never have, they live in a totally different world to you. And as a result, they don't write documents the way you'd like them to sometimes. And we have to therefore read very carefully with an eye to a number of different types of context that we might miss if we weren't careful. And I'm just going to mention a few different sorts of context you have to be wary of when reading the Bible properly, because if you don't read it with these contexts in mind, it looks like a right muddle. So, a number of examples. One objector raised this, and this is one objection of those 8 or 9 I totally agree with. They said, it really bothers me when people read the Bible as if it's all literal commands of God. And I would say, yeah, it really bothers me too. There's all sorts of stories in the Bible that are not commands of God to me and not meant to be taken literally. We'll look at a few as we go. So we need to read it in context. Here's a few examples of what I mean. We need to read it in literary context, i.e., we need to find out what kind of literature is this? What type of writing are we talking about here? And how is it meant to be read? So in England, if you see a document that begins once upon a time, you know it's a fairy story. If you read a document that begins January 17th, London, you know that it's a news report. And you are able to, without even knowing it, you immediately discern what sort of writing you're reading. When you're reading ancient literature, that might not be so common. And you might find it harder to pick up the book of Isaiah or the book of Genesis or the book of Revelation and figure out what kind of writing you're dealing with, because people in our day don't necessarily write the same way as they did. And so we've got to ask the question not, is this literal? Because actually lots of the Bible isn't supposed to be literal. Instead, we ask the question, what did the original writer intend his readers to understand? And when you do that, you end up with a much clearer understanding of a lot of things. Here's an example of a book of the Bible where if you read it literally, you end up in a total mess. Okay, it's a book called The Song of Songs. It's a very erotic and sexually charged love poem between two people. So a man and a woman writing poems to each other about sex. And Christians have in the past often found that rather difficult to cope with. And if you read it literally, you end up in a total muddle. This is the picture of the woman that would emerge from reading the book literally. Okay? Because the poet says, for instance, your eyes are doves, which in their world would have meant your eyes are soothing and calming and beautiful and peaceful, whereas if you read it literally, it would mean you literally have doves in your head. And they then when I say in my world, if I say to my wife, your temples are pomegranates, she just stares at me. She goes, what on earth do you mean? But in their world, that would have meant something. It would have meant sensuous, or it would have meant, I don't know, luscious or fruity or juicy, I don't know, but something, I imagine, like that. You can work with me. You can kind of guess. Certainly, the hardest one to get right, if I ever said to Rachel, your hair is like a flock of goats dancing down Mount Gilead, you and I would look at me and say, well, for a start, she's blonde, so no, they really don't look like that. But in their world, goats were not white, they were black, and if to see them descending down a hill, sort of shimmering down in waves, would have said, you have this beautifully kind of shiny, radiant, jet black hair, which I find so sensuous. You could imagine how that could be erotic poetry in one generation and a total nonsense in another. Your breasts are fawns. I've never said that to any woman, least of all my wife. Just want to be clear, but again, in our world, that's not something you say. It's just not the way you communicate in our language. And so this would be an example of needing to read the Bible with literary care. What type of writing is it? And therefore, how is it supposed to be read? So if you meet somebody who says, I read the whole Bible literally, I simply say, no, you don't. Because you know that that poem is not presenting a picture of a woman who looks like that. It's actually supposed to be quite beautiful. So you've got to read it in literary context. You've also got to read it in what I'm calling authorial context, the context of the author. What is the author trying to achieve with this document? Here's an example from Proverbs, okay? Two next to each other, these two, writing. You read the Hebrew text, they keep running from one into the next one. In fact, they run the other way because they write kind of backwards. But anyway, answer not a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him yourself. Next verse, answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. And you and I say, which are we supposed to do? If somebody says something foolish, do I answer him in the same spirit, or do I just ignore him because he's being silly? And of course, that is not, in that sense, you might say, that's a contradiction. And well, if you want to be really pedantic, I suppose you could put it that way, but it's a very deliberate one, and it's being done because the writer is not saying these things are both true and untrue at the same time. The writer is saying a bit like what we say when we say yes and no. You know, have you ever said that to someone? They ask you, yeah, well, yes and no. And what you mean is yes in this sense and no in that sense. Well, that's what he's doing. But it's not a contradiction in the sense of this person doesn't know what they're doing and it's full of mistakes. And that's not the nature of the writing. And actually, to take a bigger example, you read the book of Job. If you know the book of Job, that book of Job is quite like that. There are long speeches in the book of Job that at the end of the book we find out do not represent the way God thinks about things. They're actually mistaken in their perspective on God. And there might be other texts like that too. So, got to read literary context, authorial context, if that doesn't sound too, you know, fancy word. Historical context. What was the world like back then? What did this social custom mean? What did that law mean? How did people do things? So again, a lot of the charges about the Bible being brutal are often based on just a misunderstanding of historical context. And you say, you compare that with other Bronze Age documents like it, and you'll find there's a massive step forward in the ethics and the humaneness of the way the laws or the society worked. You read it in narrative context. How do narratives work in making you believe things? The other night, I watched Schindler's List. It's just what you do. You have 3 hours in an evening, watch a black and white movie about the Holocaust. Why not? And I did. And at the end of Schindler's List, you'll notice there is no sort of drifting phrase appears across the screen saying, and this is to show that killing Jews is a bad idea. Because everybody who's watched the film knows that that's true. So it doesn't tell you what to think, because the story itself does that for you. And actually, you would not watch Schindler's List and say, this is an appalling film because it seems to be saying that killing Jews is okay. You'd say the whole point of the story is that it's not okay, and you just need to read it with an eye to what the narrative is trying to do. Similarly, when you're watching the BBC coverage of what's going on in Crimea, you do not write to the BBC and saying, this is appalling. You seem to be saying that we're allowed to wander into other people's countries and take countries. And the BBC would say, no, we're not at all. We're just telling you what happened. And in telling you what happened, we are actually assuming and hoping that you will draw certain conclusions. And so the objector that we started with, who said, the Bible is full of hideous moral lessons, I suspect the problem is that person may well have read all large swathes of the Bible and read them as if Schindler's List was trying to tell me the way I should treat Jewish people, which is not the point. And so you're supposed to read the book of Judges is like that. You read Judges, you're not supposed to go, oh, that's how I'm supposed to live. You read the book of Judges and you say, this is the kind of anarchy that nations descend into when they reject God and don't have a king. And so again, if you see the Bible is full of moral lessons, you will end up really missing the point of quite a lot of it, because a lot of the Bible is not like that. So you've got to read in narrative context. A couple more. You've got to read in covenant context. So where in the big story are we? There's chapters of God's dealings with people and the story moves on. So in one chapter, it says, show them no mercy. For this period of time, I want you to drive out these people from this bit of land because of what they're doing. They're sacrificing children, they're idolatrous and everything. Drive them out, make sure they don't come back. But at a subsequent juncture in the story, love your enemies. And that's the ethic we'd live by now. And so people would say, that's a mess, it doesn't fit. And you say, well, the story's moved on a lot in between times. And an example I found online of that this week, this is Nelson Mandela, who died last year. Most of us know enough of the story of Nelson Mandela to piece together why he'd have said these things. In 1964, this is what he said at the opening of his Rivonia trial. We felt that without violence, there would be no way open to the African people to succeed in their struggle against the principle of white supremacy. In other words, violence is necessary at this point in the story. 26 years later, he's out of prison, and he says, great anger and violence can never build a nation. We're striving to proceed in a manner and towards a result which will ensure that all our people, both black and white, emerge as victors. You and I could read those quotes next to each other without knowing the story and think, this guy's a total muddle, Nelson Mandela contradicting himself left, right, and center. But those of us who know the story would say, yeah, but a lot happened in those 26 years in South Africa. And whether you agree with him or not, you would say that is not inconsistent with that, given the change that's happened in the nation in between. And you've got to read the Bible that way too. And it'll help you make sense of a lot of things if you do. And finally, you've got to read the Bible in theological context and understand that the picture of God that you get in the Bible develops. And there's things in the things about God, the Trinity, for instance, that are not taught clearly early on, that become clearer as you go until the revelation in Jesus comes at its sort of fullest, highest form. And you see, that's what God is like. So there's a lot of different kinds of context you've got to read this book with. And if we don't, we end up in a muddle. And we end up, sometimes it will sound like fiction or fairy stories or brutal or contradictory because we may not have read it right. And so we're asking the question, who'd base their lives on a brutal, contradictory book of fairy stories? And I'm saying no one. And no one does. And I'm saying that firstly because it's not a brutal, contradictory book of fairy stories, the Bible. It's a library of ancient documents involving all sorts of different types of writing, all of which need to be read carefully in context. But the second reason I'd say no one would base their lives on a brutal book of fairy stories is because actually, ultimately, nobody bases their lives on the Bible anyway. That's not what Christians do. We don't base our lives on the Bible. We base our lives on Jesus. And that really matters. It might sound like I'm playing games, but I'm not. That's a very important distinction to make. And two objectors actually picked up on it. Two of the objections we read out. One person said, Christianity is based on a single, highly questionable source, the Bible. Another person said, you only believe the Bible's God's word because it says it is, which is self-referential and invalid. But neither of those things are actually true. As Christians, what we do is we follow Jesus as a person. Forget the Bible for a moment. We follow Jesus, the Jew from Nazareth. He's born about 5 BC. We're not quite sure when. He's crucified outside Jerusalem under the Roman governor Pontius Pilate in 30 AD. He rises from the dead 2 days later. That Jesus is the one we follow as Christians, and he's the one we base our lives upon, not the book. All right, you will not find, I'm pretty certain, I haven't actually yet heard the song list, but I'm pretty sure as Sally leads out in the second half of the meeting, none of the songs will be songs of praise of worship to the Bible. That's not where we base our lives. We base our lives on Jesus, and that is very different actually. So what we do is we get our understanding of who Jesus is and what he was and what he meant and how to live like him. We get our understanding of that from historical documents that you can even now go and see copies of in the British Library or British Museum if you want. So you can go to the British Library today and you can find, if you want to, this document, which is called the Codex Sinaiticus. A codex is just an ancient word for a book that was bound a particular way. And if you could take the time to learn how to read New Testament Greek or Koine Greek in capital letters, which I'm sure you all can do already, you'd be able to read it and translate it easy, right? You just go through, that's a portion of a bit of the Gospel of Luke. It's a historical document, and you could go and read that. And Rachel and I did this. The British Library. I know how to treat a girl well. So when we went to Dublin, I went to see the Chester Beatty Papyri. And she said, can we please go and see the Guinness Museum? And I said, I want to go and see the Chester Beatty Library. And we went and stared at ancient Greek, because I can read it. And you'd start reading Greek through these glass cases. And I was thinking, this is amazing. This is like within 80 years of the event actually happening. Here's here's this document, and it's based on things like that, which obviously we then translate and we put into Bibles, but that's not, it doesn't get its, if you like, its authority simply from being in the Bible. It's a historical witness to the person of Jesus. And there's loads of them. There's 4 biographies, 20-odd letters. And what we do is we take those together, we form a historical picture of who this man is and who he was. And when coupled with eyewitness testimony, historical documents, and our personal experience of his resurrection power in our lives, those things come together and we say, that means Jesus must be this kind of person. We conclude that Jesus was Israel's king or Messiah. We conclude that he rose from the dead historically, that that actually happened. We conclude that he demonstrated to us what God was really like. And because of that, so we go from our historical evidence and we take, then go to Jesus. And because of that conclusion about Jesus, we then say, so what do we make of the Jewish scriptures then? What do we make of these letters and these biographies? Do they have authority as well? Or is it just, and what we do is we see the way Jesus spoke about and engaged with the Jewish scriptures. And we say, he treated these things as if they're true, as if they have authority, as if they matter, as if they speak to us in an accurate way about the world. So from there, we conclude that the Bible is to be trusted. That's how Christian belief works. It doesn't work by somebody saying, here's this text. Where did the text come from? Don't know, just believe everything in it. Oh, I better conclude Jesus is God. That's not what happens. In other words, we don't base our belief in Jesus on our belief in the Bible. We base our belief in the Bible on our belief in Jesus. And that's totally different. It really matters. So what we do is we see Jesus, we understand who he is. As a result of that, we trust him, we follow him, and we seek to imitate him. And that's why we trust the Bible, because he did. So we look at the way he approached the Bible and we take that attitude ourselves and honor the Bible ourselves. And sometimes it's confusing, complex, and very ancient brilliance. We sometimes don't get it all the time, but we do that because of our relationship to and our trust in Jesus. So there's 2 reasons I'm saying. Nobody would base their lives on a brutal, contradictory book of fairy stories for 2 reasons. Firstly, that's not what the Bible is. Secondly, Christians don't ultimately base our belief on the Bible. That's not the foundation at the bottom. The foundation, when you go all the way down, is the person of Jesus Christ. And on him, we then say, so now we're going to form other beliefs about authority and about truthfulness and about history and things. We will build on his foundation, which involves trusting the Bible. But that's not where we got the belief from in the first place. And with that in mind, it might be helpful then in these final few minutes to go back to the objections we started with and just give a few signposts about how you might address them quickly. And so these are my answers, but you know, other people here might answer them slightly differently. But the first one was this. My objection is the hypocrisy of the Bible and how Christians seem to be able to ignore it. For example, the many contradictory verses in the Bible are usually met with, that's not how it's supposed to be interpreted. To which I would say, it's simply my experience that almost always when somebody says, the Bible contradicts itself, and you say, where, the answer that somebody gives demonstrates that somewhere it has been misinterpreted. I've had that experience probably hundreds of times. I've been in conversations with people, and they said, but your book is full of contradictions. And you say, give me an example. And when they give you an example, that we've had a number of examples like this through the Big Objection series and at Printer's Bar and others, you then say, okay, which one? Tell me the text. Give me, okay, text, okay, chapter and verse, okay. That doesn't mean what you're saying it means. Look, that's not what the words mean. That's not what that turn of phrase means. If you read Greek, you know that that isn't what this means. And then you begin to put them together and actually make all sorts of sense out of things that people assume, because they're reading it as if it's addressed to them, that they understand what it means, and they may well not. So that one, I kind of plead guilty a bit on that and say, yes, I do often tell people that's not how to interpret it, but that's based on genuine effort and study on my part. It's not based on a sort of, no, we can't ever listen to the idea that the Bible might be wrong. It's actually based on just hard work going, that language doesn't work like that. Ancient documents don't always work like that. So I think a lot of allegations about the Bible are based on mistaken interpretation. So I kind of understand where that objector's coming from, but I just think it's true. The second objection, you assert the Bible's the word of God, but that's only what its human authors claim. So how exactly can you convince me without this loop and invalid recourse to what the Bible says that what it says really is the word of God? Again, there I'd say, because of Jesus. Jesus is the difference. I'm building my belief in the Bible on the person of Jesus. Who do you think Jesus was historically? Make sense of him for me. And if at the end of that process you conclude this is Israel's king and Israel's God in human form who died for the sin of the world and broke the power of death, you would believe, wouldn't you, what he said about the Bible. That's where we got there. So that's the answer for that one. The next one said the Bible's written by humans in the Bronze Age and much of it how the world was made, where evil came from, is profoundly illogical and was clearly written as a mythical interpretation of reality in a pre-scientific age. Well, yes, pre-scientific age. No, a lot of it isn't mythical, although some of it, you, depending on what that word means, you might say it's very poetic and rich with allegory. You might say that, but that it's essentially, we looked at science a few weeks ago, and if that's your challenge, you think, how do we handle the beginning of the Bible? I preached on that a few weeks ago. That might help you. But when it comes to the account of evil, I've got to disagree with that objection and say, there is no way that the account of human evil is illogical. I don't think there's ever been a deeper, richer, more satisfying account of the problem of evil in human beings than there is in Genesis chapter 3. God says, you need to, if you obey me, you will find life. But if you become your own God and run off and run your own show so you get to decide what's good and what's evil, you'll lead to destruction. And ever since then, I think probably every human being who's ever lived, except Jesus, has lived out that drama in their own life. I can choose happiness if I submit, or I can choose independence, but it leads to misery. And all of us choose independence that leads to misery. And you can see that as evidenced in, you read Paradise Lost, pretty long treatment of that subject. You read My Way, Frank Sinatra's song, you get a much shorter treatment. You read Invictus, you have a look at a toddler having a tantrum or a marriage that's struggling to get back on the rails. And actually a lot of the time it's just based on people saying, I will not submit, I will not back down, I will not let you shape who I am, and I'm going to hold on to this grievance. And you'll find that time and time again, human society lives out Genesis 3. I think it's far more profound than anything Freud or Maslow or anybody else ever said. And we could talk more about that. But I don't think it's illogical at all. I think it's incredibly deep. The next objection was, my greatest doubt in Christianity is the fact that the entirety of its doctrine is based on a single, highly questionable source, the Bible. And I'm saying, no, it's not, actually. It's based on Jesus. Yahweh says, show them no mercy. Jesus says, love your enemies, yet Christians claim both are God. Yes, and that's the one we talked about using the Mandela illustration. A lot has changed in that period of time. The next one, I don't like the idea that a group of people or book written by people has the power to judge others and know right from wrong. This one's fascinating, right? So the person is saying, the idea that there is somebody out there who can tell me what's right and what's wrong really bothers me. That's the first sentence. The second sentence, I've often wanted to explore religion, but I find it unreachable and incompatible with my fundamental values. Which is actually somebody saying, I determine it to be wrong. I determine, my values are right, and I determine it to be wrong. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm not mocking that person, actually. That's what we all do all the time. We look at systems of belief or other people, and we make judgments about what's right and wrong. That's what it means to be human. But that, therefore, isn't a reason to reject Christianity, religion, or anything else. Actually, all that's going on is Christians, like everybody, are saying certain things are right and certain things are wrong. The difference is, what's the foundation for that belief? Is the foundation for that belief a broadly secular consensus we've reached in the last 15 years? Or is it the idea that there is a creator God who loves the world who has spoken? And that's the difference between the Christian belief and the person who's objecting there. Two more to go. People who think that every single thought or idea presented in the Bible is a literal commandment of God, regardless of context. And I'm saying, absolutely, I agree with that objector. I probably wouldn't use the word prejudice because it sounds so negative. I might say bias or perspective, but basically, yes, I agree entirely. Well done. And that's actually, in many ways, that objection answers some of the other objections, which is very helpful. And then the final one. My neighbor objects because although his wife's a Christian, he cannot believe the Bible stories. They seem like fiction to him. And I would just say it depends on which Bible stories you're talking about. But if what you mean by fiction is something that didn't actually happen in reality, then you might well be reading a bit of the Bible that is fiction. Some of the Bible's supposed to be fiction, right? A man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and there he encountered a guy who'd been beaten up in the ditch and all this, you know, whatever. You say that actually that is not meant to be a literal story of something that actually happened. It is a parable. It's a way of telling truth through something that didn't really happen. You just got to read the Bible carefully to figure out which is which. But if you're reading Luke's gospel from beginning to end, and you're saying it describes Jesus' ministry, what he did, what he said, where he went, how he died, how he rose, that is meant to be taken as a historical account, so you read it differently. So that objection, depending on what your neighbor's husband, what they're actually wrestling with, they may well be right that parts of it are, in that sense, meant to be taken, what you might say, fictionally or non-literally. Now, ultimately, as I've said, Christianity is based on Jesus, and that doesn't mean the Bible's a red herring. The Bible is immensely important. I honor the Bible. I study the Bible. I'm studying a PhD in the Bible. I'm reading the languages of the Bible. I really care about the Bible. But it is not the foundation of our belief. The foundation of our belief is the person of Jesus. And there are all sorts of questions off the back of this that you might have. You may be wanting to ask things, throw things, dialogue with things, clarify things, come back and say, you misrepresented what I meant, or I think that, and that may be true. If so, I'm sorry. We will have a chance to talk much more about this at these events we're running at Printer's Bar, which is next to the greenhouse down in the town center near the station. On the 13th of April, we have the second of our two events there at 8 p.m. It would be brilliant to see you. If you want to come and have dialogue, debate, reason it through, ask more questions, that's exactly what it's for, and we'd love to see you. But in the meantime, thank you so much for your attention and for listening, and I'm going to hand back to Steve as he just introduces the offering.